and extremely socially isolated. And then something happened around 1910, and all those graphs began to go in the right direction.
The first sign of this change was in that written archive Robert analyzed. After 1900, the ratio of I to we words began to shift. More and more writers began talking about the collective good rather than the individual.
They essentially said, what we've inherited from our parents is a society that's really out of whack. Even if we're ourselves doing fine, we have obligations to other people.
This urge, Robert argues, led people to start banding together in clubs, in associations, in teams, and in unions. Americans got more involved in charities and civic bodies and in politics. Citizens began pressuring their elected officials to use the we rather than the I to shape policies.
Things in America were getting better and better. We were economically growing. We were equal. We were taking care of each other. We were attending PTA meetings. We were focused on the we. We were like this amazing country.
Robert calls this change the upswing. It's a phenomenon that he thinks should give us a lot of hope about the fate of society and social capital today. The upswing reveals that our great-great-grandparents faced pretty much the same problems we have today, and they were able to make the cultural changes needed to successfully switch course and rebuild social capital.
You know, it does not have to be this way, and for most young people today, that is news.
In the last episode, we talked about the importance of individual action in improving social capital. We extolled the virtues of becoming a joiner, of going to third places and meeting your neighbors, to build the bonds of community and trust that make us all happier. But Robert's study of the upswing shows that's only part of the solution. We also need a cultural shift. Our entire society has to focus on the we rather than the I. And that means we need people at the top to start taking social capital seriously and to back it with policies and money, which kind of sounds like a huge hurdle. These days, when I start to feel despair, I think back to Robert Putnam's work and a little insight he shared when we spoke, a saying told to him by a dear and wise friend.
Optimism, he said, is a passive virtue. Hope, he said, is an active virtue. Hope says, I can see how it could go in that direction, and I'm going to work to make it go in that direction. That's what he means by an active virtue. So now I don't know whether I'm optimistic about America or the world now, but I am hopeful. I can see how we could get there. And I'm doing my damnedest by preaching to move us in that direction.
You're listening to WREV FM Burlington. This is James. And the name of the show is Radio Lyceum. Thanks for the callers. Caller just called in. What you were just listening to was Make America Happy Again. It's a little excerpt from Dr. Laurie Santos from the Happiness Lab. We're going to be doing some snippets from a book, one of my favorite new books that have come out recently, called Social, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Connect, by Matthew D. Lieberman. 100% worthwhile checking out this book, for sure. It's been of the lots of different sources that I've collected and trying to make this show, over 200. This is probably the thing that stuck out the most. So we're going to some excerpts from that. I'll probably mix in a little bit of music in between some of these. This is going to be a little bit longish. So keep on listening. Like I said, you want to reach out, you can check out the show email. That's radiolyceum@protonmail.com. You can call here at 656-4399 if you want to call in and chat a little bit. I got to mix in between, so I might have to cut you off a little bit. So let's get right back into it.
1984. President Ronald Reagan and his challenger, former Vice President Walter Mondale, held the second of two nationally televised presidential debates in the run-up to the presidential election. President Reagan remained popular, but his support was softening in light of growing concerns about his age. His poor performance in the previous debate, 3 weeks earlier, had opened the door to questions about his mental fitness. If reelected, Reagan would become the oldest sitting president in U.S. history. He was 73 at the time of the debate. Reagan's performance at this final debate is frequently cited as a turning point in the election, when Reagan's popular support solidified, contributing to the largest electoral landslide in history. How did Reagan demonstrate that he was still in command of all of his faculties? Did he display his erudition on the current issues of the day? Did he play to his own strengths by vigorously attacking Mondale on issues like foreign policy or the tax code? No. It was Reagan's comedic timing that allowed him to carry the day. Reagan delivered a series of prefabricated one-liners with aplomb, regained his momentum, and never looked back. The most notable zinger came when the moderator asked him if age was a concern in the election. Reagan famously replied, "I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience." Mondale, not exactly a spring chicken at 56, later commented that he knew at that very moment he had lost the campaign. That night, nearly 70 million Americans watched the debate and came away convinced that the Gipper still had his mojo. Any fears people had that President Reagan had slipped were assuaged. But how we as a nation reached this conclusion on that night is surprising. Reagan himself didn't change our minds about him. It took a few hundred people in the audience to change our minds. It was their laughter coming over the airwaves that moved the needle on how we viewed Reagan. Social psychologist Steve Fine asked people who had not seen the debate to watch a recording of it in one of two ways. Some individuals saw clips of the debate and the audience's reaction as it was played on live television, while others saw the debate without being able to hear the audience's reactions. In both cases, viewers heard the president deliver the same lines. Viewers who heard the audience laughter rated Reagan as having outperformed Mondale. However, those who did not hear the laughing responded quite differently. These viewers indicated a decisive victory for Vice President Mondale. In other words, we didn't think Reagan was funny because Reagan was funny. We thought Reagan was funny because a small group of strangers in the audience thought Reagan was funny. We were influenced by innocuous social cues. Imagine watching the debate yourself. Or maybe you did watch it. Would you think audience laughter could influence your evaluation of the candidates? Would you be influenced by those graphs that CNN shows at the bottom of the screen during today's debates to indicate how a handful of people are responding to the candidates moment by moment? Would it sway your vote? Most of us, I suspect, would say no. The notion that our decision about who should be the president of our nation could be altered by the responses of a few people in the audience violates our theory of human nature, our sense of who we are. We like to think of ourselves as independent-minded and immune to this sort of influence. Yet we would be wrong.
We can give a perfectly sound biological account of why there should be pain and pain behavior. What we want is a similarly anchored account of why there should be hilarity and laughter. I wrote that more than 20 years ago and more or less promised to provide that account in that book. When I thought about it good and hard and did some reading, I was as stumped as any Neanderthal could be. It was an embarrassment. I just gave up. And then along came Matthew Hurley. This is a perfect illustration of what Steve Miden was just telling you about the extended mind. Matthew is a student of mine who showed up, and he wanted to do a theory of humor. And I said, much too hard, much too hard. Do something else. No, he would not be dissuaded. And this resulted in the Hurley model of humor in the book that we published together just a year or so ago. The paperback's just out. Inside Jokes Using Humor to Reverse Engineer the Mind. This cartoon, in a way, was the inspiration for Matthew Hurley's model. He began to notice that in many languages, there's a word like funny in English, which has two meanings, nicely exemplified here. There's funny, uh-oh. What's that funny smell? What's that funny noise? And then there's funny ha-ha. And it turns out that's true in a lot of languages. We've got a good dozen that there's a term like this. And he decided that was actually an important clue. And the clue really is that humor always begins with a bit of a mistake. It always begins with a tiny uh-oh, which is then resolved almost immediately into, oh, never mind, it's okay. And it's this down-up, starting off with a little bit of negativity, a little down, followed by a little bit of up. The same point's been made in a wonderful book by David Huron called Sweet Anticipation about music. Now, Huron's book is about reverse engineering the mind using music as a probe. Ours is about using humor as a probe. As he says, pleasure is increased when a positive response follows a negative response. While surprise is biologically bad, surprise nevertheless plays a pivotal role in human emotional experience. Surprise acts as an emotional amplifier. We call this the Huron trampoline. We sometimes intentionally use this amplifier to boost positive emotions. That's one of the keys to our model. Covert entry is very important in humor. The mental spaces filling up with all this furniture as life goes on easily cluttered up and they get easily contaminated. And what happens is that mistaken premises enter without notice. They enter covertly. And this is important to achieve the groundwork for making something funny. I'll give you an observation which just makes this point in spades. If there is a joke that in order to understand it, there is some fact you have to know. And you want to tell a joke to somebody who doesn't know that fact. And you tell them the fact first. Then you tell them the joke. No humor at all. No humor at all. Because the fact entered not by covert entry, but entered very publicly. If the facts that the joke depends on aren't common knowledge so that you don't have to mention them, so that they will automatically get generated in this helter-skelter mental space furnishing, you're not going to have humor. That's, of course, also the main reason why humor doesn't travel all that well, how it often depends on very small groups of people who happen to share the same basic tacit understanding.
Every day, others influence us in countless ways that we do not recognize or appreciate. If this is true,
so that was a little snippet that I tied in from Daniel Dennett, who passed away last year, 2024. Definitely one of my favorite contemporary philosophers, modern philosophers. Probably going to cover a little bit more of him in some future episodes. I'm not sure how I'm going to tie it in with some other things, but definitely a very influential thinker of our age, and very interesting talking about how humor affects the brain. I've heard other talks where he talks about it. It's sort of like he believes it's like a error correction of the brain. It's where you see something bad that happens and your brain's like, oh, that's something I probably don't want to do, but something that lives right on the edge of maybe people might consider okay or not okay. Humor often lives right on the edge. That's why it's often considered, some humor might be considered offensive by some people, because you're kind of playing that game between what's acceptable and unacceptable, or if you're in on the wordplay about, you know that this is unacceptable. And so it's a very very interesting like inlet into how the human brain works. So anyway, we'll get right back to social, why our brains are wired to connect.
Why would our brains be built to be unwittingly influenced by people we don't even know? Before judging the gullibility of our gray matter so harshly for using audience reactions to make sense of Reagan, let's take a moment to appreciate just how difficult it is to read other people's minds, to discern their character from the things they say and do. Thoughts, feelings, and personalities are invisible entities that can only be inferred, never seen. Assessing someone else's state of mind can be a Herculean undertaking. Was Reagan still Reagan? Or had his mental faculties diminished? How could we know the difference without extensive neurological examinations? We all engage in this kind of mind reading of others every day. And it is so challenging that evolution gave us dedicated neural circuitry to do it. While we tend to think it is our capacity for abstract reasoning that is responsible for Homo sapiens dominating the planet, there is increasing evidence that our dominance as a species may be attributable to our ability to think socially. The greatest ideas almost always require teamwork to bring them to fruition. Social reasoning is what allows us to build and maintain the social relationships and infrastructure needed for teams to thrive. That the brain has a network devoted to this kind of mind reading of others. The surprising thing is that even though social reasoning feels like other kinds of reasoning, the neural systems that handle social and non-social reasoning are quite distinct and literally operate at odds with each other much of the time. In many situations, the more you turn on the brain network for non-social reasoning, the more you turn off the brain network for social reasoning. This antagonism between social and non-social thinking is really important because the more someone is focused on a problem, the more that person might be likely to alienate others around him or her who could help solve the problem. Effective non-social problem solving may interfere with the neural circuitry that promotes effective thinking about the group's needs. The presence of a dedicated system for social reasoning in our brains still doesn't explain why most people watching the presidential debate were so affected by the responses of the audience. In this situation, the social reasoning system appears to have failed, resulting in distorted perceptions of the debate. Some part of our minds mistook anonymous audience laughter as a valid indicator of Reagan's mental vigor. Why would we substitute the judgment of others for our own? This was no momentary lapse. The world is filled with such laugh tracks and other contextual cues because our brains are designed to be influenced by others. Our brains are built to ensure that we will come to hold the beliefs and values of those around us. In Eastern cultures, it is generally accepted that only by being sensitive to what others are thinking and doing can we successfully harmonize with one another so that we may achieve more together than we can as individuals. We might think that our beliefs and values are core parts of our identity, part of what makes us us. But as I'll show, these beliefs and values are often smuggled into our minds without our realizing it. In my research, I have found that the neural basis for our personal beliefs overlaps significantly with one of the regions of the brain primarily responsible for allowing other people's beliefs to influence our own. The self is more of a superhighway for social influence than it is the impenetrable private fortress we believe it to be. Our socially malleable sense of self, which often leads us to help others more than ourselves, is the third major adaptation I'll be discussing. Social networks for social networks. Most accounts of human nature ignore our sociality altogether. Ask people what makes us special, and they will rattle off tried-and-true answers like language, reason, and opposable thumbs. Yet the history of human sociality can be traced back at least as far as the first mammals more than 250 million years ago, when dinosaurs first roamed the planet. Our sociality is woven into a series of bets that evolution has laid down again and again throughout mammalian history. These bets come in the form of adaptations that are selected because they promote survival and reproduction. These adaptations intensify the bonds we feel with those around us and increase our capacity to predict what is going on in the minds of others so that we can better coordinate and cooperate with them. The pain of social loss and the ways that an audience's laughter can influence us are no accidents. To the extent that we can characterize evolution as designing our modern brains, this is what our brains were wired for: reaching out to and interacting with others. These are design features not flaws. These social adaptations are central to making us the most successful species on Earth. Yet these social adaptations also keep us a mystery to ourselves. We have a massive blind spot for our own social wiring. We have a theory of who we are, and this theory is wrong. Is to get clear about who we are as social creatures, and to reveal how a more accurate understanding of our social nature can improve our lives and our society. Because real insight into our social nature has gained momentum only in the last few decades, there are tremendous inefficiencies in how institutions and organizations operate. Societal institutions are founded, implicitly or explicitly, on a worldview of how humans function. These are theories regarding the gears and levers of our nature that institutions try to operate on in order to strengthen society. Long before there were any primates with a neocortex, mammals split off from other vertebrates and evolved the capacity to feel social pains and pleasures, forever linking our well-being to our social connectedness. Infants embody this deep need to stay connected, but it is present through our entire lives. Mind reading. Primates have developed an unparalleled ability to understand the actions and thoughts of those around them, enhancing their ability to stay connected and interact strategically. In the toddler years, forms of social thinking develop that outstrip those seen in the adults of any other species. This capacity allows humans to create groups that can implement nearly any idea and to anticipate the needs and wants of those around us, keeping our groups moving smoothly. Harmonizing. The sense of self is one of the most recent evolutionary gifts we have received. Although the self may appear to be a mechanism for distinguishing us from others and perhaps accentuating our selfishness, the self actually operates as a powerful force for social cohesiveness. During the preteen and teenage years, adolescents focus on their selves and in the process become highly socialized by those around them. Whereas connection is about our desire to be social, harmonizing refers to the neural adaptations that allow group beliefs and values to influence our own. Inverting Maslow. In 1943, Abraham Maslow, a famous New England psychologist, published a paper in a prestigious journal describing a hierarchy of needs in humans. The hierarchy he identified is typically depicted as layers of a pyramid. Maslow suggested that we work our way up the pyramid of needs, satisfying the most basic needs first, and then, when those are satisfied, moving up to the next set of needs. At the bottom of the pyramid are physiological needs like food, water, and sleep. The next level of the pyramid focuses on our safety needs, such as physical shelter and bodily health. Physiological and safety needs are really fundamental needs with a capital N. No one can do without them. The rest of the pyramid consists of nice if you can get them needs or needs with a small N. My son may say he needs another scoop of ice cream, but really he just wants one. He will survive without it, even if he thinks he won't. In Maslow's pyramid, the remaining needs, the extra scoops of ice cream, are love, a sense of belonging, and being esteemed. Self-actualization, that is, reaching one's full potential, is the cherry on top. Ask people what they need to survive, and there is a very strong probability that they will produce answers from the bottom tiers of the pyramid, like food, water, and shelter. Infants need food, water, and shelter too. The difference is that infants have no way of getting these things for themselves. They're absolutely useless when it comes to surviving on their own. What all mammalian infants, from tree shrews to human babies, really need from the moment of birth is a caregiver who is committed to making sure that the infant's biological needs are met. If this is true, then Maslow had it wrong. To get it right, we have to move social needs to the bottom of his pyramid. Food, water, and shelter are not the most basic needs for an infant. Instead, being socially connected and cared for is paramount. Without social support, infants will never survive to become adults who can provide for themselves. Being socially connected is a need with a capital N. This restructuring of Maslow's pyramid tells us something critical about who we are. Love and belonging might seem like a convenience we can live without, but our biology is built to thirst for connection because it is linked to our most basic survival needs. As we will see, connection is the first of three adaptations that support our sophisticated sociality. But our need for connection is the bedrock upon which the others are built. Physical injury leads to bodily pain, which motivates us to find shelter and rest so that our body can heal itself. If our social needs really are basic survival needs with a capital N, then unmet social needs should be experienced as a pain with a capital P too. This sentiment was expressed by noted neuroscientist Paul McLean, who wrote, "A sense of separation is a condition that makes being a mammal so painful. Is there a link between the pain of physical harm and the pain of social harm? Is social pain real? Pain may not be all in your mind, but it is a lot more in your mind than most people realize. I don't mean to suggest that the psychological aspects are somehow done away with. I am not a reductionist. Rather, in daily life, we tend to create an artificial separation between things like pain and emotion. Pain, emotion, and all that we experience are necessarily simultaneous expressions of psychological and physical processes. Starting from this view, it is not beyond the realm of possibility that something as seemingly as abstract as social pain could be just as tangible and just as painful from the brain's perspective as physical pain. I do not mean to suggest that physical and social pain are identical. No one has ever broken his arm and confused that with having been dumped by his girlfriend. And memories of social pain are much more intense than memories of physical pain. Different kinds of pain feel differently and have distinctive characteristics. What I am suggesting is that social pain is real pain, just as physical pain is real pain. Understanding this has important consequences for how we think about the social distress that we and those around us experience. Since then, non-sedating levels of opiates have been shown to reduce separation distress cries in a variety of mammalian species. Moreover, reconnection between mother and infant increases opiate levels naturally in both parties. This suggests that the same neurochemical that is instrumental in alleviating the distress of physical pain may also be central in alleviating the distress of social separation in infants. This was the first hard evidence that social and physical pain are treated in similar ways by the brain. First, the ACC is one of the neural adaptations that distinguishes mammals from our reptilian ancestors. We have cingulates, and reptiles do not. It makes sense to expect that new psychological processes first emerging in mammals, like attachment and social pain, might be linked to new mammalian brain structures like the ACC. Second, the ACC has the highest density of opioid receptors of any region in the brain. So it makes sense that physical and social pain may well be linked to this specific region. Third, it has been shown that the DACC plays an instrumental role in the experience of physical pain. Last, the DACC has been linked to mother-infant attachment behavior in various non-human mammals. We spent the better part of the next year analyzing the data, but there was a single moment when we knew we might be on to something interesting. Looking at the screen side by side, without knowing which was an analysis of physical pain and which was an analysis of social pain, you wouldn't have been able to tell the difference. These findings highlighted one of the things fMRI research can do to help us understand the human mind in general. It can illuminate when two mental processes that seem different actually rely on common neural mechanisms, suggesting they are more psychologically intertwined than we would have guessed. Here, the mammalian need to recognize social threats appears to have hijacked the physical pain system to do what the pain system always does: remind us when there is a threat to one of our basic needs.
So I just wanted to cut in again just to talk about that subject. We covered it a little bit last week about the connection between social isolation and pain. I also want to put it out there that there's a lot more nuances to how pain is affected in the brain, and how in particular drug addiction there's other segments of what could cause addiction, not just necessarily social isolation. So as much as studies have kind of shown that, but there's definitely a solid connection where this scientist in particular was studying areas of the brain. You could see where social isolation lit up the same areas of the brain that are associated with pain. But overall, addiction is a little more complex. So some people can be have a predisposition to get addicted to drugs. So it's a little more complicated than that. But it's also very fascinating to see how that part of the brain that is wired for pain has been hijacked for, particularly in humans, to kind of push us into social relations or to be social. So, I mean, I think the whole point of this book that he lays out the point extremely well is how humans are uniquely social animals, more than almost any other mammal, more than other animal on the face of the earth. And it explains lots of things in a way to push back against the homo economist, who's purely self-interested. And if you look into the brain science, that's not the case. And you also could tie into philosophy, where what kind of morals that humans have and what morals don't have. So it's almost like a base where you can kind of expand out a lot of philosophical ideas about where's morality come from. So a subject that I'll probably be covering later in other episodes. Philosophy is a very deep and long history, especially the history of morality. So we're going to get into another part of this book. It's almost news and weather time, so I'll have to cut in and do a little snippet from news and weather and public service announcement. But in the meantime, you can reach out at radiolyceum@protonmail.com. If you have any nonprofits that you want to potentially come on the show, I have a list of quite a few people that I always would like to come on already, but I'll put you on the list. And in particular, I'm looking for nonprofits that have volunteers and are looking for volunteers, and are a part of their mission is to reach out to the community. Politically neutral would be ideal, but we'll cross that bridge when you come there. So keep on listening to Your Better Alternative, WRUV FM Burlington. We'll be right back.
Why don't we know? If you scanned my brain while I ate a scoop of salted caramel ice cream, you would undoubtedly find increased activity throughout my brain's reward system. Or you could save a lot of money on fMRI scans and just ask me if I love salted caramel ice cream. When it comes to ice cream, our conscious experiences and our brains tell the same story. So why isn't it the same with social rewards? Why doesn't it seem like being treated fairly would feel good? Why don't we recognize that there is something intrinsically rewarding about helping others that does not depend on believing one will benefit materially? Research suggests the reason is that we feel compelled to tell everyone how selfish we are, even if we aren't selfish. I was recently at a meeting of the social psychologists in my department, professors and graduate students. The area chair made a point of thanking Kelly Gildersleeve, a graduate student who had spent a lot of time over the summer streamlining a bureaucratic process by moving it to the internet. When everyone in the room heartily applauded her effort, Kelly blushed and blurted out that she was going to benefit from the streamlining as well. So she would be getting something out of it. It was a complete lie. The time she put in will never be offset by the savings she will get in her last year of graduate school. Kelly told me later that even as she heard herself saying this, she knew it wasn't true. But she said those selfish-sounding words anyway. Kelly helped because she is a kind and thoughtful person who saw a problem and knew she could help. Kelly helped because it is intrinsically rewarding to help those around you. For some reason, though, when someone asks us why we help, we often find ourselves saying things that makes us sound more selfish than we are. Dale Miller, a social psychologist at Stanford University, has identified the root cause of this faux selfish behavior. The theorizing of Hobbes, Hume, and other intellectuals, who claim that self-interest is the source of all human motivation, has produced a self-fulfilling prophecy. Their theory, and everyone who repeats it, have affected how the rest of society behaves. Because we have been taught that people are self-interested, we conform to this cultural norm to avoid standing out. Miller has shown in multiple experiments that we assume others are far more self-interested than they really are. In one study, he asked individuals what percentage of undergraduates they thought would agree to give blood for $15 and what percentage would agree to give blood if there were no financial incentive. Respondents estimated half as many people would give blood for free as would for the money, 32 versus 62%. But in measuring actual volunteer rates, he found that those who were offered no money agreed to give blood 62% of the time, only slightly less often than those who were paid, 73%. Because of these mistaken assumptions about everyone else's selfishness, we tend to avoid appearing altruistic ourselves. We don't want to appear to be boasting or come off as a goody-two-shoes. If you believe that people in general don't think altruism exists, then claiming your own actions are altruistically motivated feels like putting yourself on a pedestal. For this reason, when people are asked why they have engaged in pro-social behaviors, they tend to ascribe their actions to self-interest. I volunteer because I'm bored, and it gives me something to do. When we regularly hear other people giving selfish-sounding reasons for their altruistic behavior, it only serves to bolster our belief that all behavior is self-interested, which in turn makes us less likely to admit our own altruistic motives. The cycle is self-reinforcing, becoming more and more ingrained over time. The irony of this was brought home in another of Miller's studies. People were approached to donate to a charity. People who were asked to simply donate found it hard to generate a self-interested explanation for helping.